Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
All week we've been talking about science in America. We've heard from the head of the National Science Foundation, the only physicist in Congress, and we've talked about science education. Today, we want to put our series in context with a look back at the history of science. And joining us is David Kaiser, who's a professor of the history of science and a physicist at MIT. He's also the author of a number of books, including How the Hippies Saved Physics. Dr. Kaiser, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
So who were some of the key players in the history of science, particularly in the 20th century?
Oh, that's such a long list. You know, one thing that's pretty amazing is that there have been more scientists alive and working now than cumulative since the Earth began. More and more people entering the field over time. So it's hard to pick out, you know, your favorite top 10.
I assume Einstein would be on the list.
I would think Einstein has a pretty good shot. Yeah, we haven't knocked him off the list yet. Other people whose names are well known, like Stephen Hawking, probably are still worth thinking about, to be sure. But it's a huge list, and it has some people who became household names and many, many others who were doing incredibly important work who we might not know so much about.
And when you look at where they're coming from, are they mostly people who were living in the United States or other countries?
There's a huge switch around the middle of the 20th century, sort of basically as World War II was drawing to a close. And the big scientific powerhouses, at least as we measure them by sort of spending on research or publications in the journals, that had really been places like Germany, and it's sometimes in history at Russia and other places. And then in the middle of the 20th century, it really shifted pretty solidly to the United States. An enormous investment in basic research coming out of the war, a huge ramping up of the enrollments in science classes. Think about kind of Sputnik era calls to get more young people interested in science. So by the 1950s, 1960s, the U.S. really had a kind of global dominance in the field.
If you look back over the past 1,000 years, what would be the biggest points in the history of science, the moments that really stand out to you?
Part of what interests many of my colleagues and I in the field is actually looking at things that even in hindsight might not seem to have changed the world. But trying to get into the head of someone who inhabited such a different way of thinking, had different tools at her or his disposal, what even seemed like a question to them. So instead of just finding our kind of greatest hits, which would clearly be biased by our own sort of sense of where we are today, a lot of historians really enjoy trying to get into what feels like a different planet, you know, to get into a foreign world. So that makes it harder to create a kind of greatest
hits. But if you had to had to come up with a few moments that with this discovery, we are able to move forward to the next step in a number of different fields.
I think about Copernicus and think about how the Earth is moving around the sun. This Earth need not be the static center of the universe. That was a pretty big shift. The shift was not overnight in people's thinking. It took many hundreds of years.
And that was when, Copernicus?
So Copernicus was working in the 1500s. Uh-huh. He published his famous book in the middle of the 1500s, actually on his deathbed. And then we have all the great work in astronomy that came to after that, people like Galileo and Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler. And then people like Isaac Newton pulled a lot of that together and really unified an enormous body of work in the late 1600s, early 1700s.
In Cambridge, Isaac Newton.
He was doing a lot of that work in Cambridge. Some of it he had to do out of Cambridge because of the plague. So actually he was in in other parts of England for parts of that. But that's right. He was otherwise based largely at Cambridge. And then, you know, we have a kind of steady drumbeat from there. We would certainly pause to think about the work that Einstein was doing and the world he kind of lived in. And then after that, and again, the numbers then grow so rapidly once we get to, say, the middle of the 20th century. We're talking about an activity that involves, you know, many hundreds of thousands of people. It's an enormous enterprise.
And looking at right now, the period that we're in right now, are we in a renaissance for science at the moment, or does it just seem that way because we're living it?
I don't know if we're in a renaissance. We're certainly, I think, in a moment of transition. I think there was a kind of model, especially in the United States, for how to support scientific research that really, again, grew out of World War II, was really amplified by concerns about national defense in the Cold War. And for a wide range of motivations, what that meant was an enormous amount of money, huge government investment in basic science and in the training of young scientists. And I think there is a lot of frustration these days. That model, at least, is no longer at play. So we have some very generous support from private foundations, from generous individual donors, certainly a lot of government support. But the balance has shifted, and I think that you can see that in the types of projects that can move forward these days.
One of your books is called How the Hippies Saved Physics. So how did the hippies save physics?
So the title was tongue-in-cheek. But I was writing about this group of really curious, really fascinating people who did their PhDs in the U.S. and some of the leading programs in the U.S. In the late 60s, early 70s, kind of boom years. And then very rapidly, those boom years turned to bust. There's a cycle we've seen repeat a couple times in the last half century. And these folks were caught where their one miscalculation was entering grad school right before the job market collapsed. No funding, no jobs, huge shift in kind of expectations. So they bumbled along. They made their way to San Francisco because if you're going to be unemployed in 1975, you might as well be unemployed in San Francisco. They weren't dopes. They found each other. And they discover they have this shared real passion about these kind of grand mysteries of the universe. What does quantum mechanics tell us about matter at its most fundamental? These are really deep, deep, hard questions. And they really pushed hard on topics that are now at the forefront, like quantum entanglement, what Einstein famously called spooky actions at a distance. These folks were among the early adopters, saying that's really weird and that's really important.
So when you say that, I have to say, and especially when your book is called How the Hippies Saved Physics, I have to wonder whether the drug use in the 60s, seriously, help people come up with ideas that they hadn't come up with before?
It's a tricky question. Certainly, people have made the argument both ways. With this particular group, you know, some of them, at least as they told me years later, had definitely been, you know, kind of stereotypical hippies. Mm-hmm. They spent a lot of time at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, where one mainstay, at least for some folks, was experimenting with psychedelics. We have to remember that many psychedelics weren't even illegal until the mid to late 1960s. These were seen as fascinating substances to expand the powers of mind. They became illicit, and then the kind of culture around them began to shift in the middle of that period. So some of them told me, at least, they were way into the drug scene. Others said, no, that wasn't for me. So it's hard to come down too strong either way.
And I guess we'll never know on that one. What about the dark times in the history of science? What have those been?
Well, again, I think in hindsight, we can see many of them. Ironically, what historians used to call the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages actually we now think was pretty vibrant intellectually. There's all kinds of cool stuff going on, sometimes in Western Europe, sometimes in other parts of the world, like in the Middle East, in Persia. But there are sort of ebbs and flows in more modern times. And a lot of it, unfortunately, does get tied to the kind of priority cycles in various nations or whole parts of the world. Is scientific research something that society should really invest in and support? Or is it a kind of secondary luxury that's not going to get top priority? And I think you can really see kind of horizons shift. People's imagination can get swept up in whether they can even imagine building a tool to test something or not.
There are also times in the history of science where the government in power at the time, the idea that was coming out from the scientists was so provocative that it was threatening to them. And we look back on that now and say, well, that's terrible. I can't believe that they stopped that person from doing that research. Are there ideas now that do the same thing that we may, you know, 100 years from now look back and say, I can't believe we didn't allow this scientist to continue with their research because that idea was so threatening to the government of the time?
I don't know of too many where the research itself has stopped because it's seen as a threat. We certainly have, you know, a huge challenge on our hands with understanding things like global climate change, global warming, where there's actually a lot of research going on, and the research lines up remarkably well. But the conclusions to be drawn from that are
difficult for some people to deal with, especially economically, right?
Absolutely. So that's an example where people aren't necessarily censoring the work, although there have been, I think, some real dangerous incursions into the peer review process, into snooping around individual scientists' emails. I think some of it starts to feel a bit like a witch hunt, a kind of McCarthy era thing. Hopefully that's a momentary, lapse. So I don't know about overt censorship. I think my bigger concern would be which amazing, great, crazy-sounding ideas simply couldn't be pursued because of lack of resources, because it seemed a little too beyond the mainstream and couldn't get enough support to really do it. I mean, a lot of scientific research these days is pretty expensive.
On the flip side, if you look back over the history of science, is there a moment when everything worked perfectly, that there was a place? You know, I think of all of these small college towns around the United States as these wonderful little places where people from all over the world have come and these ideas are melding together. But is there a time and place from the past that we should look to and say, this is the kind of place that we want to recreate now?
I don't know. That's tricky. I think nostalgia can be a kind of false guide here. So there are some constants, some things that never change in university life. Faculty always claim the students aren't working hard enough. Students always complain about, you know, this and that. Faculty need more parking spaces. I mean, there's some things that simply don't change. And people saying they don't have enough resources to pursue their research is one of those kind of constants. So here's an example that sometimes people would say, well, what about this golden age of Galileo? He was given, at least for a time, enormous resources by private patrons, by the de' Medici family, to pursue his work. Wasn't that a kind of, you know, glorious isolated space? Until he realized, well, it didn't quite work out that way. He had all kinds of trouble maintaining ties with the leaders. The new pope wasn't so pleased with some things he was writing. So it's hard to find a kind of golden age when everything just clicked. But I don't know that we have ever sort of got it right and should go back to that. It's a constantly kind of moving stream.
That's David Kaiser, who's a professor of the history of science and a professor of physics at MIT. Dr. Kaiser, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.